And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's November the 12th. 316th day of the year. Leap year is 317th. 49 days remain till the end of the year. On this date in history, in 954 A.D., 13-year-old Lothar III is crowned at the Abbey of St. Remy as King of the West Frankish Kingdom. Now, to get a job like that at the age of 13, the stars were in your favor. In 1028, future Byzantine Empress Zoe takes the throne as Empress Consort of Romanos III, Argios. 1330, Battle of Prazada ends. Dolowalachian Voivode Basarab I defeats the Hungarian army by ambush. 1439, Plymouth becomes the first town incorporated by the English Parliament. In 1892, Pudge Hellofinger becomes the first professional American football player on record. With a name like Pudge, what else could you do? Participating in his first paid game for the Allegheny Athletic Association. 1893, Abdurrahman Khan accepts the Durand Line as the border between Afghanistan and the British Raj. 1905, Norway holds a referendum resulting in popular approval of the Stortinget's decision to authorize the government to make the offer of the throne to the of the newly independent country. 1912, King George I of Greece makes a triumphant entry into Thessalonica after its liberation from 482 years of Ottoman rule. 1912, the frozen bodies of Robert Scott and his men are found on the Ross Ice Shelf in Antarctica. Now, for those not familiar with Robert Scott, he was a captain. His name was actually Robert Falcon Scott. He was a Royal Navy officer and explorer who led two expeditions to the Antarctic regions. The Discovery Expedition of 1901 through 4 and the ill-fated Terra Nova Expedition of 1910 through 1913. On the first expedition, he set a new southern record by marching to latitude 82 degrees south and discovered the Antarctic Plateau, on which the South Pole is located. Nothing says that they actually found a pole. On the second venture, he led a party of five that reached the South Pole January 17, 1912. Less than 5 weeks after Amundsen's South Pole expedition. Planned meeting with supporting dog teams from the base camp failed despite Scott's written instructions and at a distance of 162 miles from the base camp and approximately 12 and a half miles from the next depot, Scott and his companions died. When Scott and his party's bodies were discovered, they had in their possession the first Antarctic fossils ever discovered. They were determined to be from the Glossopteris tree and proved that Antarctica was once forested and joined to other continents. Actually, it was discovered that underneath that ice are two different land masses. Well, 1918, Austria becomes a republic. After the proclamation, a coup attempt by the Communist Red Guard is defeated by the Social Democratic Volkswehr. 1920, Italy and the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes signed the Treaty of Rapallo. 1927, Leon Trotsky is expelled from the Communist Party for threatening Lenin's control. That leaves Joseph Stalin in undisputed control of the Soviet Union. 1928, the SS Vestris sinks approximately 200 miles from Hampton Roads, Virginia. Kills 110 passengers, mostly women and children, who die after the vessel is abandoned. 1933, Nazi Germany uses a referendum to ratify its withdrawal from the League of Nations. 1936, in California, the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge opens to traffic. 1940, World War II. The Battle of Gabon ends as Free French forces take Libreville, Gabon, and all its French Equatorial Africa from the Vichy French forces. The Vichys were basically pro-Nazi. The Free French were anti-Nazi. Also in 1940, Soviet Foreign Minister Vyacheslav Molotov arrives in Berlin to discuss the possibility of the Soviet Union joining the Axis powers. Had they done that, we'd all be speaking German right now. 1941, temperatures around Moscow drop to minus 12 degrees centigrade as the Soviet Union launches ski troops for the first time against the freezing German forces near camp near the city. Also 1941, the Soviet cruiser Shervona Ukrainia is destroyed during the Battle of Sevastopol. 1942, naval battle of Guadalcanal between the Japanese and American forces begins near Guadalcanal. The battle lasts for 3 days and ends with an American victory. 1944, Royal Air Force launches 29 Avro Lancaster bombers which sink the German battleship Tirpitz with 12,000 pounds of Tallboy bombs off Tromsø in Norway. 1948, in Tokyo, the International Military Tribunal for the Far East sentences 7 Japanese military and government officials, including General Hideki Tojo, to death for their roles in World War II. 1954, Ellis Island, which is where most immigrants first landed, ceased operations. 1956, Morocco, Sudan, and Tunisia joined the United Nations. 1956, in the midst of the Suez Crisis, Palestinian refugees are shot dead in Rafah by Israeli soldiers following the invasion of the Gaza Strip. 1958, a team of rock climbers led by Warren Harding completes the first ascent of the Nose on El Capitan in the Yosemite Valley. 1961, Terry Joe Duperaults, the sole survivor of a series of brutal murders aboard the Ketch Bluebell. 1961, for those that are not familiar, is a 60-foot twin-masted sailing catch based out of Fort Lauderdale. November 12th,
motion detected at the front door.
1961, a series of brutal murders took place on board shortly before the ship sank. Two people survived the sinking, the murderer and an 11-year-old girl. It was chartered by an optometrist by the name of Arthur Duperault of Green Bay, Wisconsin, for a trip from Fort Lauderdale, Florida to the Bahamas. They left Fort Lauderdale on November 8th, 1961. On board with him were his wife Jean, 38, and his three children, Brian, 14, Terry Joe, 11, and Renee, 7. The ship was skippered by decorated World War II and Korean War pilot Julian Harvey, who was 44. He was accompanied by his sixth wife, Mary Deaney, 34, whom he had married in July. According to interviews Terry Joe gave to the U.S. Coast Guard, on November 12th, the Bluebell began its return journey to Fort Lauderdale. At some point during the day, Terry Joe went to the lower cabin to rest, leaving her family, Harvey, and his wife on deck. Later that same night, Terry Joe woke up by screams, went on deck to discover Harvey had killed his wife, stabbed Dr. Duperault, Jean, and Brian to death. Harvey shoved her below deck before he scuttled the sailboat and prepared to leave in a dinghy. When Harvey was later picked up by the tanker Gulf Lion, the drowned body of Renee was discovered in the dinghy with him. Now, Terry Joe was able to untie a 2x5-foot cork float and launch herself just as the ship sank. Drifted for 4 days without food and water, she was rescued in the Northwest Providence Channel by the Greek freighter Captain Theo. Harvey was picked up 3 days later in the dinghy along with Renee's dead body. He told the U.S. Coast Guard that a squall had brought down the Bluebell's mast, put a hole in the ship's hull, ruptured an auxiliary gas tank, and started a fire. Claimed he found Renee floating in the water and tried unsuccessfully to revive her. The autopsy showed she died of drowning. After Harvey was informed that Terry Joe had been rescued, he checked into a motel under an assumed name and committed suicide with a razor blade. It's believed that Harvey planned to kill his wife to collect on her $20,000 Dublin indemnity insurance policy. But Dr. Dupperault discovered it, and then he proceeded to kill him, his wife, and two of his children. He believed they had witnessed the murder. Later found that Harvey had survived a car accident that claimed another of his six wives and her mother, and that his yacht, Tarbatross, and his powerboat Valiant had sunk under suspicious circumstances. He got large insurance settlements on those. If you don't like them, divorce them. Don't kill them. 1969, Vietnam War. Independent investigative journalist Seymour Hersh breaks the story of the My Lai Massacre. 1970, the Oregon Highway Division attempts to destroy a rotting beach sperm whale with explosives, leading to the now infamous exploding whale incident. 1970, the 70 Bahola cyclone makes landfall off the coast of East Pakistan, becomes the deadliest tropical cyclone in history. 1971, Vietnam War. As part of Vietnamization, Richard Nixon sets February 1st, 1972 as a deadline for the removal of another 45,000 American troops from Vietnam. 1975, the Comoros joins United Nations. 1977, France conducts the Ariete nuclear test, its 14th in a group of 29. The French nuclear test series ran from 75 to 78. 1979, Iran hostage crisis. In response to the hostage situation in Tehran, U.S. President Jimmy I'm in charge Carter orders a halt to all petroleum imports to the United States from Iran. 1980, the NASA space probe Voyager 1 makes its closest approach to Saturn, takes the first images of its rings. 1981, Space Shuttle Program, Mission STS-2, utilizing the Space Shuttle Columbia, marks the first time a crewed spacecraft is launched into space twice. They're reusable, don't you know? 1982, USSR. Yuri Andropov becomes the General Secretary of the Communist Party Central Committee, succeeding Leonid I. Brezhnev. 1990, Crown Prince Akihito is formally installed as Emperor Akihito of Japan, becomes the 125th Japanese monarch. 1990, Tim Berners-Lee publishes a formal proposal for the World Wide Web, and the rest is history. 1991, Santa Cruz Massacre. Indonesian forces open fire on a crowd of student protesters in Dili in East Timor. 1995, Erdut Agreement regarding the peaceful resolution to the Croatian War of Independence is reached. 1996, a Saudi Arabian Airlines Boeing 747 and a Kazakh Ilyushin 276 cargo plane collide in midair near New Delhi. It's the deadliest midair crash up to that point in time. They killed 349 people. 1997, Ramzi Youssef is found guilty of masterminding the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. 1999, the 7.2 Dusi earthquake shakes northwestern Turkey with a maximum Mercalli intensity of 9. At least 845 people are killed and almost 5,000 are injured. 2001, in New York City, American Airlines Flight 587 and Airbus A300, en route to the Dominican Republic, crashes minutes after takeoff from John F. Kennedy Airport, kills all 260 on board, and they kill 5 on the ground. 2001, war in Afghanistan. Taliban forces abandon Kabul ahead of advancing Afghan Northern Alliance troops. 2003, Iraqi war. In the Shiraz, Iraq, at least 23 people, among them the first Italian casualties of the 2003 invasion of Iraq, are killed in a suicide bomb attack on an Italian police base. 2003, Shanghai Transrapid sets a new world speed record, 311 miles per hour for commercial railway systems, which remains the fastest for unmodified commercial rail vehicles. 2011, Silvio Berlusconi tenders his resignation as Prime Minister of Italy, effective November 16th. due in large part to the European sovereign debt crisis. 2011, a blast in Iran's Shahid Madarez missile base leads to the death of 17 of the Revolutionary Guard members, including Hassan Tehrani Moghaddam, key figure in Iran's missile program. 2014, the Philae lander, deployed from the European Space Agency's Rosetta probe, reaches the surface of the comet 67P, Churyumov Gerasimenko. 2015, two suicide bombers detonate explosives in Burj al Bahari in Beirut, kills 43, injures over 200 others. 2017, 7.3 Kermanshah earthquake shakes northern Iran-Iraq border with a maximum Mercalli intensity of 8. 410 are killed, over 7,000 are injured. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays, birth of Sun Yat-sen, also Doctor's Day and Cultural Renaissance Day in Republic of China. Christian Feast Day, Arsatius, Asterik or Anastasius of Pannonhalma, Kumini Fota, Cunibert, Emilian of Cogolia, Amoris of Immortal, Josephat, Kunt Savach in the Roman Catholic Church and the Greek Catholic Church. Abunus, the Venus of Ghent, Makar, Margarito Flores Garcia, Lilith of Sinai, Patins, René d'Angers, Theodore the Studite, Yamar, Constitution Day in Azerbaijan, Father's Day in Indonesia, National Health Day in Indonesia, National Youth Day in East Timor, and World Pneumonia Day. If you're going to get it, I guess today's the day to get it. Let's see what we've got. In 295, we have the origin of the Era of Ascension. 764, Tibetan troops occupy Chang'an for 15 days. That's the capital of the Chinese Tang Dynasty. 1555, the English Parliament reestablished Catholicism. It had been outlawed when the Church of England came into being. 1591, the Castilian army occupies Zaragoza. 1661, Robert Hooke appointed curator of experiments to the Royal Society in England. 1682, Swedish King Karel XI establishes an absolute monarchy. 1723, Ambrose Godfrey patents a gunpowder fuel fire extinguisher system in England. To get mud out the fire, they can blow up the building. 1793, the first mayor of Paris, Jean Sylvain Bailly, is guillotined during the Reign of Terror. 1799, Andrew Ellicott makes the first known record of a meteor shower observation in the U.S. from a ship off the coast of the Florida Keys. 1847, Sir James Young Simpson, a British physician, is the first one to use chloroform as an anesthetic. 1859, Jules Leotard performs the first flying trapeze act in Paris. He also designed the garment that bears his name, the Leotard. 1880, best-selling American novel Ben-Hur, A Tale of the Christ, was written by Lew Wallace, who was a Union Army officer. It was published on this date in 1880. 1899, British troops reached Durban, Natal. 1900, the Exposition Universelle, the World's Fair in Paris, closes after it has 50 million visitors. In 1910, the very first possible movie stunt, man jumps into the Hudson River from a burning balloon. In 1914, Turk's Sultan Jamal Pasha declares a German holy war. In 1919, Ross and Keith Smith start a one-month flight from London to Australia. And finally, in 1920, Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis elected the first baseball commissioner. With all that having been said, let us turn our attention back to the lost ship of Noah, which we've been talking about for the last day or so. Now, we talked about the Ruskovitsky report about the Russian expedition to the Ark under the Tsar. And whether or not that report is true, false, or partly true, it generated on its own the most definite source in centuries, resulting in a reappraisal of the Ark legend. It is somewhat noteworthy that it was only after the 1916-1917 time period that a number of sightings of the Ark previous to 1916 became public knowledge. These also included a number of personal visits to the Ark, the bringing back of worked planks and timbers found at high altitudes where there would not be normally any wood, and even deathbed confessions from one person who had been afraid to tell about his experiences and others who had attempted to discredit the Ark's existence after seeing it. Many of the subsequent visits to Ararat had been encouraged and inspired by other sightings from the air during the period between the wars, then during World War II, and even after that. As far as can be ascertained, none of these air probes by military aircraft, helicopter, satellite, or space shuttles have been looking for the Ark, but in some cases have come across it unexpectedly or have found a ship-like profile outlined in a photograph. Now, photographs in the air from space have reportedly shown a great ship on the side of the mountain, but no definite or identifiable photograph of a wooden ship on Mount Ararat's yet been made available to the public. But it must be kept in mind that NASA has hundreds of thousands of photographs they do not release to the public. We pay for them, but they don't show them. During the military supply operation between the USA and the USSR in World War II, considerable air traffic developed between the main U.S. base in Tunisia and the Russian base at Erivan in the Armenian Soviet Socialist Republic. It was during 1943 that two American pilots flying near Mount Ararat thought they saw something resembling the outline of a great ship thousands of feet below them. Upon retracing the earlier flight, they were accompanied by an Air Corps photographer who took a picture of it. Subsequently published, according to a number of witnesses, on the front page of the Mediterranean edition of Stars and Stripes. Now, Stars and Stripes is a U.S. Armed Forces newspaper, and that photograph is only one of a number of pictures allegedly taken of the Ark during World War II by U.S., Australian, and especially Russian airmen. A number of people do remember having seen them, but the photographs, sure a common feature, they can't be found. Some Russian pilots have reportedly shown pictures of a large ship on an ice-covered mountain to Allied airmen during the period of the munitions airlift from the south, alleging it was a photograph of the Ark. But the Russian pilots, in all cases, refused to let the pictures out of their hands. Now, this is an understandable refusal considering the active anti-religious policy of the Soviet regime. And the photographs taken by American pilots have also seemed to vanish, even the one published by the Stars and Stripes. It disappeared somewhere among the old files of the Mediterranean editions of 1943. Now, all things considered, it might be that the Stars and Stripes photograph was a picture of a volcanic rock formation not on Ararat, but almost 20 miles away, which does possess the approximate shape and dimensions of the Ark of Legend. Now, a number of American pilots saw a ship-like construction protruding from the side of Mount Ararat in the late spring or summer of 1960. These pilots were based in down in Turkey with the 428 Tactical Flight Squadron under the NATO Military Assistance Pact in effect at that time. The pilots have been told about the ARC by the Turkish liaison pilot assigned to them, and on several occasions have been guided past Mount Ararat on routine observation flights. Now, these pilots didn't have time to make any successful photographs because of their haste to make a quick turnaround the mountain before becoming an object of unusual interest by Russian observers on the USSR side of the border. Captain, then Second Lieutenant, Gregor Swimmenhammer, now a commercial pilot, was interviewed about in 1981 concerning a barge-like object he had seen on Mount Ararat, as described in the book Doomsday 1999. He stated the Turkish liaison officer that accompanied him and another pilot on a counterclockwise swing around Mount Ararat, in the course of which they saw an enormous boxcar or rectangular barge visible in a gully high up on the mountain. Captain Swinghammer specified it seemed to be banked, indicating it wasn't stationary but moving and movable, and somehow had become caught there as it slid down the mountain. He remembered he had later heard at the base club that some pictures had been taken of this object, reputedly by the U-2 pilots prior to the unexpectedly sudden ending of the U-2 program when Gary Powers was brought down over the USSR and captured by Soviet air action. Captain Swinghammer was interviewed again in August of 1985, and a number of other former pilots of the 428 Tactical Flight Squadron. This was an attempt to ascertain whether some of the memories of the icebound ship on Ararat coincided with other subsequent sightings. And they were asked, what did the other pilots think about what you and they had seen? And he said, we used to talk about it in the bar after flying. Some of the pilots thought it was the Ark, and others didn't know what to think. I wasn't convinced, he said, about that, but I knew that I had seen a large rectangular building like a barge or a ship high up on the mountain. He was asked, how far away from the object were you when you saw it? And he said, we were coming down from 5,000 feet. I think we were at more like 3,000 feet when we sighted it. I remember we were doing 380 knots. The Turkish liaison officer said to us, that's where Noah's Ark's supposed to be. Look, you can see it now. He said, I estimated I saw it at a 45-degree angle. Appeared to be hanging at 45 or 30 degrees down the mountain. He was asked if he took any photographs of it, and he said, no, we're in too much of a hurry. We had 2 hours of fuel, and it took us 45 minutes to get there in the F-100. Had time enough to make just one pass around the mountain and return, and we had to be careful. The Russians had a radar installation right at the border. A C-130 had recently been shot down. Well, other pilots in the squadron remember having taken part in flights over Ararat, having heard that other pilots had seen a ship-like object on the mountain. Lieutenant Colonel Ben Bothorp, who was a first lieutenant at the time, said, I was the deputy base commander at the time. Greg Swinghammer was there at that same time. A Turkish pilot told us the Ark was on the side of the mountain. It seemed logical to me. We took a bunch of flights around the area looking at castles and ruins, and then on Ararat we saw something different. About two-thirds of the way up the mountain made of wood, and it looked like a boat or a wooden boat-shaped wall. I don't know who first said it was Noah's Ark. We all discussed it, he said. You know, people who think they've seen the Ark have occasionally made sketches of it or instructed artists how to draw what they'd seen. An unusual coincidence occurred when William Krause, Ararat explorer and senior minister of probe ministry, sent Captain Swinghammer a booklet called The Search for Noah's Ark. Which described search activities on Ararat and difficulties encountered in 1985. The booklet contained a sketch of the Ark made by Alfred Lee, a longtime Ararat explorer, under the direction of an eyewitness. The witness was an Armenian named George Agopian, an ex-shepherd, claimed to have climbed up to the Ark in 1905 at the age of 10 and have seen it on several other occasions. According to the Armenian witness, he had even walked along the roof of the giant ship. Now, Swinghammer, who had never previously seen the picture dictated by the witness, had independently asked one of his acquaintances to draw a picture of what he had seen. The two pictures were essentially the same. The Ark banked in the snow, the position of an outcropping of the mountain, and even the shape of the barge or ship, with the exception of the openings along the top of the structure seen from the ground, but too small to have been visible from the aircraft. The pilot and the shepherd, unknown to each other, had seen and described the same icebound ship, evidently at a time that was partially visible outside the ice. And although it is intriguing to find that separate viewers have sketched similar pictures of the Ark, the lack of photographs and the fact that photographs had subsequently disappeared is a recurring disappointment to researchers about this great ship. Some of the mysterious disappearances of photographs kind of lend a James Bond flavor to Ark investigation. In 1952, an oil engineer named George Jefferson Green, a passenger in a helicopter reconnaissance flight for an oil company, flew around Mount Ararat. He noticed what seemed to be a large prow of a ship emerging from the ice. This was on the northeast side of the mountain where so many sightings have occurred. On his orders, the pilot maneuvered the helicopter to points as close as 100 feet from the object, during which time Green excitedly used up a roll of film on the unusual object. When he developed those photographs, he found they showed a ship-like form located in a gully between a high cliff wall and a precipice, partially receding into the snow or glacier in back of it. In other words, essentially, the description and situation given by other viewers. Allegedly, the picture had been taken from a close enough distance to show laminated planks on the ship's hull. Green made a number of prints and showed them to acquaintances in an attempt to obtain backing for his own expedition to Ararat. According to Ark researcher Earl Cummings, Green wasn't successful and the expedition didn't take place. Later, Green went to British Guiana to work with a mining company. He was murdered there in 1962, presumably in a robbery. His valuables, which may have included the close-up photos of the Ark, were never located. Although a number of people who stated they'd seen those photographs were contacted by Cummings, no copy of any of the photos was ever located. The use of space satellites and space shuttles, in their detailed inspection of much of the Earth's surface, it could be hoped that some photographs of Mount Ararat would reveal information about the presence of the Ark, especially at the points where viewers have claimed to have seen it. One photograph taken from space in 1974 by the Earth Research Technical Satellite revealed, after intensive enlargement, an unusual feature on the side of the mountain at the altitude of 14,000 feet. This photograph was discussed by Senator Frank Moss, then chairman of the Senate Aeronautical and Space Sciences Committee, in a speech made to the Utah section of the American Congress on Surveying and Mapping. He stated that an unusual object in one of the folds of the mountain was about the right size and shape to be the Ark. This section of the mountain photographed was shot at an altitude of 450 to 500 miles, and the area is similar to the type of crevasse on the side of the mountain where the Ark or some other unusual construction had been seen by pilots. But any objects seen from that height, as well as being half under the snow or in the shadow of a crevasse, would be almost impossible to identify, even under extreme enlargement. One thing is certain, though. Whatever it is not an optical illusion, which can come easily to straining eyes, but not to sophisticated cameras. Future air inspection of Mount Ararat, especially during the late summer melting of the ice, and preferably by helicopter, might reveal the hidden ship in the upper region of the mountain, where a number of people claimed to have seen it, approached it, and even touched it. Despite the lack of clear or attainable photographs of the Ark on Mount Ararat, there already existed numerous photographs of a suspected Ark located within 20 miles of Ararat, on another smaller range of mountains. This alternate Ark bears a surprising resemblance to the biblical description of the Ark. Unlike the presumed Ark on Ararat, it can be visited and photographed, if you have local permission, by the relatively simple expedient of taking a taxi from Dogebayazit to the site on Akiala Range. Since its discovery in 1959, and especially after the furor in the press and television, well, it is fairly well known. It's also been theorized this alternate Ark has either been fossilized so that it blends with the terrain or it's been buried by mudslides. To differentiate it from the possible Ark on Mount Ararat, it could best be described as the buried ship in the Tenderick Mountains.
Motion detected at the front door.
Yes, we have all kinds of people coming and going around here. Those who believe in the peoples of the book, or those who belong to the peoples of the book, that's the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims, have been conditioned since childhood to the acceptance of the legend of the Ark. This legend, if legend it be, is more persuasive than some other Old Testament stories, such as Jonah and the whale, the snake in the Garden of Eden, and
the extreme ages of the Earth's early patriarchs. Because the mountains of Ararat are still there, and for thousands of years people have been hearing about Noah's Ark. Therefore, almost any unusual feature of the mountains is likely to be associated with the Ark by observers from the air, the plain, or even the nearby hills. And these observers, even if they don't realize it, are psychologically conditioned to believe in its reality. A discovery in 1959 was a result of a routine aerial survey taken near Ararat by the Turkish Air Force. The photograph was taken by the pilot, Lieutenant A. Curtis, at a ground altitude of 10,000 feet, and was sent to headquarters where they were examined by a captain assigned to photo interpretation. Now, one particular photograph caught his attention, unique because it showed a long oval hill smooth in form in an area where otherwise was marked by crevasses and gullies. This hill-like form seemed to be bounded by a raised ridge. The photograph was taken about 17 miles south of Mount Ararat. As he stared, the captain realized the oval hill was shaped like a ship. The raised side seemed to resemble a ship's gunwales, and the prow was pointed toward the Tenduric Peaks. Captain wondered what were the dimensions of this strange formation as he remembered a well-known instruction traditionally given by God to Noah. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, the breadth of it 50 cubits, and the height of it 30 cubits. Well, the dimensions of this strange hill, measured by Turkish engineers during a two-day survey, showed the length of this ark to be 500 feet, the width at the middle 150 feet, and the height of the gunwales 45 feet. This could be said roughly to correspond with the biblical measurements of the ark if we consider the size of the ark could it split during the many intervening centuries while the strong wooden planks of the hull still held their shape. Thus, they would capture mud, slide, stones, lava deposits, and still preserve their contours, clearly outlined against the rough terrain around them. Even the height would be increased on one side, as it is in an area known for earth slides, lava streams, and seismic activities as mud packed together with stones built up against the ship's walls and solidified. But where was the ark? The first Turkish team found no trace of any construction. If the ark was there, it was buried underneath its facsimile, which would serve as its tomb. An expedition formed by scientists and searchers from the U.S. under the aegis of the Turkish officers, and therefore a Turkish expedition, examined the ark hillock in the summer of 1960. Members included Professor Arthur Brandenberger, a photogrammatic specialist from Ohio State College, Dr. Siegfried, an archaeologist from the Chicago Oriental Institute, Renee Norbergen, international correspondent and author, and businessman Hal Thompson and William Bishop, George Vandeman, explorer and searcher for the Ark and leader of the expedition, Turkish officers Major Mikhail and Captain Durapinar, the air photographer interpretation specialist who had originally noticed this phenomenon, and selected officers and men of the 3rd Cavalry Regiment of the Turkish Army. The presence of the businessmen, or simply believers in the Ark, backing the expedition has been the general case in the many subsequent expeditions to the mountain. In this regard, the search for the Ark belongs in a category distinct from other treasure searches. There's no gold or treasure to be found and divided, as is the case of lost Spanish treasure fleets, or lost cities in the jungle, treasures from ancient tombs, lost gold and silver mines, or buried pirate treasure. Except for the reported plan of Archbishop Nuri to bring the Ark down from the mountain and exhibit it at the Chicago's World's Fair, the search for the Ark has been primarily a spiritual and secondarily an archaeological motive. When one meets searchers for the Ark, one's impressed by their faith and the strength of their desire to prove the Ark is there. It would go a long way toward proving the validity of many of the stories in the Bible. The detailed examination effected by the expedition verified measurements roughly equivalent to those mentioned in the Bible. Some variations would be allowed for according to the accepted length of the cubit. Also, the somewhat excessive width of the object could not be explained by the splitting of the gunwales of the ark filled with earth and was covered by lava and then more earth on top of that. Well, after some discussion among members of the expedition, the decision was reached. It wasn't unanimous, considering the presence of the accompanying archaeologist, to dynamite a portion of the supposed ark to see whether there existed evidence of wood or metal construction, remnants of pitch or stout inner timbers in conformity with reports or legendary memories of the Noah's Ark. Dynamite charges are placed and exploded by soldiers of the military escort, and no inner chamber or clear evidence of beams was discovered, although it was later claimed that bits of decayed wood was found among the debris. It appeared, and later was generally accepted, that this phantom ark was simply a natural uplift of the earth in an area of seismic activity. That it was solidified mud or lava, not the ark, even a cast of the ark. Nevertheless, this pile of lava and earth bore a surprising resemblance to what one might visualize to be the hull of an ancient ship on the ocean floor. Except here, there was no ocean, only the memory of the sea, recalled by shells and sea fossils on and under the earth and on the mountain. The simulacrum of the Ark remained relatively unnoticed from 1960 to 84, during which time a number of explorers, mountaineers, and dedicated searchers for the Ark continued their expeditions on Mount Ararat itself. Meanwhile, a number of photographs of the Phantom Ark appeared from time to time in the more sensational weekly newspapers. This is reproducing the Turkish photograph of 1959, sometimes reinforced and with heavy touching up of the original picture, which was attributed to aerial photographs by Turkish or Russian pilots. In 1984, the buried ark enjoyed a resurgence of publicity while they reported in the world press. This came as a result of an expedition that visited and inspected the object collected from its specimens of stone, lava, and soil. The team was headed by Marvin Steffens, president of International Explorations, and Ronald Wyatt, an anesthetist who had visited the site in previous years. When he came back from Ankara, Steffens announced the boat-shaped formation was indeed the ark, and he'd take a number of samples from the formation and pack them in sacks. These samples consisted of wood, soil, and stones to be analyzed upon his return to the U.S. He's also taken some samples which he planned to have analyzed in Knoxville, Tennessee. As the removal of any valuable antique, an understated but apt description of the ark, likely to provoke a negative response from any national government where the antiques are found, the Turkish government soon heard about the sacks and intercepted Steffens at the Istanbul airport as he was leaving Turkey. But it was discovered this wasn't contraband, simply 8.6 pounds of stone, sand, and earth. Innocent enough, but still officially Turkish property. In the meantime, Wyatt had taken his own collection to New York and exhibited it at a press conference. This appropriation of national property elicited considerable press action in Turkey. One editorial in the English-language Turkish Times attacked not only the taking of samples, but the lack of consideration by foreigners for the customs and regulations of the nation. Adding in a reference to the flood legend, without these considerations, we degenerate to the level of uncivilized beings that God sent the flood to the world to destroy. The incident, which interrupted other expeditions on the mountain as well, soon developed an otherworldly aspect. Colonel Irwin, the famous astronaut who walked on the moon, had in his luggage a replica of moon rock he'd collected from the moon's surface. And this rock was also seized by officials for examination as a possible legal export from Turkey until Colonel Irwin explained it wasn't archaeological and not of Turkish origin, indeed not from this world. A new investigation of the Phantom Ark took place in March of 85.
Motion detected at the front door.
This time an improved prototype of molecular frequency scanners used in order to detect whether or not there was a bulk shape or metal within the mound. Now, this molecular frequency scanner operates on the same principle as the CAT scan, used in hospitals to locate and measure foreign growths within the organs of the human body. The scanner was brought to Turkey by David Fesold, a longtime student of the Ark and enthusiastic believer in its actual existence. Not on top of Great Ararat, but on a smaller mountain range miles away. He was an ex-merchant marine officer with a master's license and an experienced underwater diver and salver who had long worked with the side-scanning subsurface radar for identifying underwater wrecks. He's more familiar with the sea than with mountains, but convinced, as he says, that with the underwater under earth, I know a ship when I see it. Well, Fassold and Wyatt visited the buried ark in March, fighting their way through deep snow. Fassold bought the scanner with him, and he determined to their mutual satisfaction there was a massive bulk or some sort of object under the snow and inside the mound. Indications of iron showed up in traceable lines crisscrossed by other lines at definite intervals. Faced with this information, the White was immediately convinced the ark had been found, suggested the iron indicated remains of great nails used for fastening beams or maybe the bars of animal cages. When he stopped for food at a gas station restaurant on their way back to Ankara, local bus and truck drivers wanted to know how they came to be so snowburned. Their car driver explained, "These Americans are heroes. They have a machine that helped them discover the Holy Ark." The somewhat premature statement called forth blessings, free food, and toast of Rocky. Fossold and Watt returned to Turkey in June with Dr. John Baumgartner, NASA research scientist from Los Alamos. This time unencumbered by snow, they identified 9 traverse lines by following the metal dots, crossing 13 long lines that seemingly outlined the hull of a great ship, curved as a ship would be, not box-like, with what would be the keel line bearing 10 degrees north toward Mount Ararat. It was therefore decided that Fossold would return to the U.S. to pick up a high-tech interface radar unit, which was also used by NASA, rented by him from Geophysical Survey Systems, and bring it back to Turkey. This machine would be capable of photographing what the CAT scan scanner merely indicated. It could penetrate 50 feet under the surface of the land and clearly depict what was inside the Ark Mound. Of course, special permission for the use of this interface radar outside the U.S. had to be obtained from NASA. Permission also had to be granted by the Turkish government for its use inside Turkey. During August, while the team waited for the unit to arrive, they began to re-examine the site. The group now included Wyatt Baumgartner, Malin Wilson, who had brought a core drilling machine, Tom Finner, an exploratory geologist who has run the interface radar, and George House, the photographer for the expedition. The previous experiment with the CAT scanner was repeated, and after a number of probes, a series of ribbons was strung over the Phantom Ark, ostensibly to follow direction lines which indicated concentrations of metal. Orange ribbons were used to determine lines going east to west, and yellow ribbons crisscrossing these going north to south. And with the ribbons in place, the outline made the object look more like a ship than ever before. Some skeptics present had observed that although at some instances the metal detector was not turned on, the lines continued to trace the figure of a ship. These first tests were psychologically aided by Ron Wyatt's running commentary to the press, television crew, and other observers. At one point, he walked over the rise between the gunwales and stated he was standing over the captain's cabin and later made reference to the tracing indicated by the ribbons as indicating iron bars marking the now buried ancient cages for the animals on the ark. Well, Fesso returned to Dugabayatsit with the subsurface interface radar recording unit and the necessary permits. But when he arrived, he found an Ararat in the surrounding area had once more been declared off limits to foreign investigators because terrorists had captured several expeditions on the upper slopes, confiscated their equipment, and chased them off the mountain at gunpoint. Although Turkish commandos soon dispersed and rounded up the insurgents, the interdiction on Ark exploration remained. Fesold was therefore unable to operate the machine, but renewed his efforts in the summer of 86. It should be observed that even if the radar recording unit doesn't eventually give positive proof of a buried ship beneath the ship-like mound, the unit could also be used on suspected areas on the mountain itself, as it's equally effective in distinguishing forms, dimensions, and details of objects under ice, snow, ice, or water, as well as those buried in the earth. Fesso considers that the location of the buried ark, 17 miles from Mount Ararat, is compatible with the Quranic mention of Mount Judi as the resting place of the ark, since Judi in Arabic simply means the heights. It's also in keeping with biblical tradition, which doesn't specifically say Mount Ararat, but the mountains of Ararat. Although the Tenderek Range is usually given as the site of the ark mound, it's actually on the nearby Akayala Range, which runs northwest and southeast, fairly close to Dugabayatsit. The section of hills where the ark is located is referred to as Maser, which means doomsday, a name reminiscent of events that in the memory of many races took place in the surrounding area. The altitude of the object is 6,300 feet above sea level, considerably lower than that estimated for the ark on Ararat. But its present level, according to Fasol's theory, is the result of a sudden slide from a greater height than the range where it had been situated since the flood occurred. The slide down the mountain resulted in it being buried in mud and sand, which by the process of silicification petrified the giant ship and preserved its shape. might have been stopped in its downward slide by a large rock formation which can still be seen piercing the side of the object, or what could be the port bulwark of the ship. Its buried ark, Faso contends, was not noticed before now because it wasn't at the place where the ark was supposed to be. And since it was sighted from the air, though, earthquakes in the area have caused it to rise, and the ground around it has eroded away, leaving the ark shape more evident. The object is effectively proved to be part of a ship. The claim that it's Noah's Ark would still be in some doubt. It is interesting to note that many of the local population know about the object, but consider it not to be the ship of Noah, which is up on the mountain, but the ship of Malik Shah, ruler of ancient times, who used a very large ship on a lake that covered an extensive area around Ararat, which may have been connected with other large bodies of water to the south and the north. A lake does still exist on the Ararat Plain, fed by underground streams from the melting ice coming from the Great and Little Ararat. During 1987, the buried ark will be examined. At least it was planned by Turkish archaeologists, as well as by a number of Americans, if they can get the necessary permission. Since the time it was first discovered, however, explorers have on one occasion dynamited it or tried to take away pieces of it for testing. Therefore, the Turkish authorities are inclined to prohibit digging or dislodging pieces of the buried ship or any other vessel found on the mountain. Lest, like certain other archaeological remains in different countries, they be partially or wholly dismantled and taken away. Fasold is convinced that for proving the artifact's identity as a ship, digging into it would not be necessary or even productive, as the artifact itself has changed its molecular composition through siliconation and is now solid. He said, "Do you know what interface radar is capable of? You could see inside the object without taking it apart. You'd be able to see beams and partitions and decks and iron bars, perhaps in place. If this buried formation proves to be a large ship, what about the other ark so often reported seen on Mount Ararat, and believed to be Noah's ark since remote antiquity? Could it be there were two arks or even more, considering the Islamic assertion that the ark was on Mount Judi? Also in Turkey, but to the south. Another on Mount Nasir, still another on Mount Dimavand in Iran, and various other landing places of several ships in different parts of the world. Nevertheless, it's the reported presence on Mount Ararat of the Ark of Noah that still holds the belief and imagination of many of the world's people. Its definite location on the mountain where it's supposed to be would be an event that would change the mood of the present world, modifying its religious, historical, geophysical, and even political concepts.
Motion detected at the front door.
This is perhaps why, besides an understandable zeal for knowledge and exploration, so many climbers on the mountain in their desire to have find it have faced danger, death, and sometimes finding both. You know, Ararat is certainly one of the world's most impressive and beautiful mountains. Impressive because it rises an abrupt 14,000 feet from a plain that's already 3,000 feet high. It's beautiful because it stands alone away from other mountains, and when the cloud cover lifts from the summit, often in the early morning and the evening, its gigantic mass and snow-covered dome causes one to raise one's head in a sort of involuntary salute to its size, mystery, and connection with mankind's most famous legend. Ararat, with its two peaks of Greater and Lesser Ararat, covers an area of more than 600 square miles. It's a volcano that's last erupted in 1840, causing the disappearance of the village and monastery of Aurora on its northeastern side and the formation of a great gorge 800 feet deep where the village used to be. A number of glaciers come down the mountain, of which the Parrot Glacier and the Abik 1 and the Abik 2 glaciers are the largest in extent and in places 200 feet thick. Ararat's ice cap covers about 20 square miles and it's thickest in the declivity between the two peaks of Great Ararat. Sides of the mountain contain a number of gorges in which explorers and pilots at different times have reported seeing what they believed to be the remains of Noah's Ark. Other sites on the mountain suggest as possible resting places for the ark, including locations above the new village of Aurora, or points underneath the glacier or still under the ice at the summit.
Motion detected at the front door.
You know, it's not at present possible to look for the ark at Aurora because of its proximity to the border of the USSR. The present favorite departure point for ark hunting expeditions or climbing parties simply interested in ascending the famous mountain is the town of Dobayatsit, which forms the southern point of an almost equidistant triangle between the Greater Ararat to the north and Lesser Ararat to the southeast. The season for the Dobayatsit expeditions is a short one, but it's a crowded one, since only in mid and late summer are climbing conditions, especially the lack of snow at lower levels, favorable for the difficult ascent. Such a time, the climber, in addition to the normal and special difficulties being encountered on Mount Ararat, also encounter a pleasant profusion of mountain flowers, flocks of sheep, horses, goats, friendly shepherds, and notably unfriendly dogs. However, there are so many dangers connected with exploration of the mountains, some mysterious and others patently obvious, that one can understand the Turkish word for Ararat, Agridag, the mountain of pain, is an appropriate description for it. According to an interview done with Ahmet Ali Arslan, mountaineer, photographer, artist, writer, and holder of a doctorate from Erzurum University about the special dangers peculiar to Mount Ararat, according to Dr. Arslan, who is considered to be well-informed on the subject because he's climbed to the summit of Greater Ararat 17 times out of a total of 37 climbs on the mountain. He was born in Aralik on the south, north side of Mount Ararat, has been climbing the mountain since 1965. He's also had considerable climbing experience on the mountains in the Pamir Range located in the Kyrgyz in the Soviet Socialist Republic. He said, technically, the climb is not too difficult, but it's been stated by scientists there's active gas, carbon dioxide, primarily on the upper slope. Now, this is in addition to the normal lack of oxygen on extreme heights, and that combination's hard on climbers and causes illness and confusion. Snow avalanches, he said, are rare, except in the spring when overhanging snow cliffs can partially melt, detach themselves, and come crashing down. This happens principally on the northeast and northwest sides. But the rock slides, like rock avalanches, are worse. Volcanic bombs, rocks, and solidified lava frozen near the crater can roll down the mountain. Some as big as trucks and with a velocity of 80 to 120 miles per hour. Sometimes a rock slide can be started by the jumping of wild goats flighting by climbers. Or a shouted command, an echo, or a shot from a rifle. Just like snow avalanches on the Swiss Alps, except here it's thousands and thousands of rocks. He said severe rainstorms and snowstorms can catch you unexpectedly on the mountain. The worst parts of a storm are the bolts of lightning which have struck immobilized climbers. And while this has happened on other mountains, it's not like that on Ararat. This is a lone, very high mountain, so it's like a gigantic lightning rod. The upper slopes are usually covered with clouds full of static electricity. And climbers carry a lot of metal equipment, picks, crampons, pitons, and things like that. The metal pins on mountaineers' hats, which we use for trading with other climbers, can attract a lightning bolt. The rocks you might try to hide behind are also dangerous if your granite blocks attract lightning. Well, he was also asked, if you go into the clouds, which cover the top part of the mountain, do you lose your way? And he said, no, you stop. If you continue, you could step over the side of a gorge or break through the partially melted ice crust over a crevasse going deep down into a glacier. That happened to two young ladies who were climbing, who disappeared on the mountain in 1985. And you don't know where the holes are. The mountain itself is a volcano and it's still hot. The fog seems to start when the hot puffs of gas come from vents in the mountain. When you pitch your tent at a camp, after a while, you can notice the earth is giving off heat. Well, we've come to the end of another show. Our time is up. We'll be back tomorrow, and once again, you'll be listening to Kent Hudnall and the Kent Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great evening.